I'd like to welcome you to the 11 o'clock section here. Do you think you're different? My name is Jesse and I'm an alcoholic. Also served a fellowship as a panel 55, Area 32 of Central Michigan, delegate to the General Service Conference. Okay, it's great to be here today. I'd like to ask for a moment of silence for AA recoveries for the past 70 years. Moment of silence, please. Thank you. And we have three speakers, Eric from New York, John from Florida, and I believe Claire from California. And our first speaker is Eric from New York. Help me welcome him.
Wow. My name is Eric, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the General Service Office and Doug R. for inviting me to be here today. And those of you who are from the Toronto area for being such gracious and wonderful hosts of this terrific party. Nothing like spending a weekend with 45 or 50,000 of your closest friends. It is indeed a delight and an honor to be here. And I lived about 10 blocks from the convention center in Minneapolis in 2000, so I have a little bit of a sense of what goes on, the type of service and degree of service that's required for this, and we do appreciate it, and I do appreciate it. When I agreed to do this, I don't know, last year sometime, they send you a letter and you sign and say, yeah, I'll be there and so forth, and I didn't really think about it again. I stuck it in my extremely untidy desk, and about a month ago, I started thinking, oh, I should, you know, make sure I've got train reservations and stuff to get to Toronto. And I pulled stuff out, including the letter, and opened it up. I'm like, okay, when is it? Where is it? Blah, blah. And the topic, do you think you're different? Well, duh. I mean, I don't know about you, but that's one of the major reasons I'm here. You know, and the extreme degree to which I pursued that idea in my life has been a little frightening at times. I, in fact, came into Alcoholics Anonymous in an effort to prove that I was different from you. I went to my first meeting to prove I did not belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, well, I'm going to go there and show that I'm not an alcoholic. There is something obviously desperately wrong with my life, but I'm pretty sure this is not it. So let's eliminate that possibility. And so I went to a meeting, and I was wrong. But that's, you know, that's essentially how I got here. It was my first meeting was an effort to prove that I was different from you, that I did not belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that first meeting was, it was almost exactly 15 years ago. My sobriety date is June 9th, 1990. Thank you. And that is the direct result of having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps at Alcoholics Anonymous. I choose to believe that that's the grace of my own personal God, but it's because of the steps have brought about a spiritual awakening in me, which I was taught is a psychic and spiritual change sufficient to overcome my alcoholism, and that has happened to me, and it has happened on a continuing basis for the last 15 years, and it continues to unfold in wonderful and interesting ways. But that first meeting, I mean, it was everything I was afraid it would be. It was, you know, it was a dingy room with a bunch of old people smoking. I mean, you know, I mean, most of them were about the age I am now, but, you know, at the time, that was old. And it was up above a lighting store in South Minneapolis, and up this flight of stairs that seemed to have about 19 million steps in it. And I had been driving by it every day for a week. Going, you know, well, that's where the alcoholics are. Yeah. If I need them. Pretty sure I don't, but just in case, they're behind that door. And I actually had 2 weeks when I walked into my first meeting, because I had made a deal with myself that I would not drink again until I talked to you. I knew a little bit, I knew, well, they do it one day at a time. So I'll do it one day at a time until I talk to them and I pass the test and then I can drink again. And but I called the wrong phone number. I didn't call the central office. That was too easy, central office. So I called a clubhouse that was fairly near my house, and they didn't have an answering machine. They didn't have someone there 24 hours a day, of course. So I called them every day on my lunch hour when no one was there, and I'd call them. And then by the end of the week, I was calling them 10 times a day, you know, because I can't drink again until I talk to them. And And finally, after a week on a Saturday, I caught someone there as a meeting was breaking up, and I said, yeah, I need a meeting schedule. And he, you know, read off to me the weekly schedule. And he said, you know, the meeting today just broke up, but we're going out to coffee. You know, we'll wait for you if you want to come. I know that's fine. That's, you know, good. Thanks. Bye. I mean, I didn't want to socialize with you people. I just wanted you to give me a test, a passing grade, and let me go on. I mean, you know, I'm a lifetime student. I understand that system. And so then I knew the schedule, and I found the address, so I knew where you were. So then for a week, I drove by every day. Going, well, that's where they are. And on the next Saturday, I woke up, and I knew, you know, I knew that I was either going to get drunk that day or I was going to go to a meeting. And I didn't know which I'd do. But I knew what the results or the potential results of getting drunk again were going to be. I didn't know what the results were going to be if I went to a meeting. So I thought, well, it's not my problem. I'm sure of this, but I'll go. So I went over there, and I you know, opened the door and climbed those 19 million steps and got up to this dingy room with these old people smoking. And they had these, you know, battered tables and battered chairs, and they were all kind of clumped in one corner. And I, of course, immediately headed to the exact opposite corner. And the whole time, my head is just screaming at me, you do not belong here. Get out before they throw you out. You know, anonymous means secret. You know, this is a secret society. You're not supposed to be here. You know, the tape. And I looked up, and on the wall was a sign that said the 12 Traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea what that was. Now, I knew of the steps. This was Minneapolis in 1990, and at that time, treatment centers were like Starbucks. There was one every 150 feet. You know, I mean, you couldn't get on a city bus without seeing the 12 steps. I mean, so, you know, you knew about the steps. You met somebody from out of town, you just assumed they were there for treatment. You know, they'd say, where are you from? They'd say, you know, New York. Oh, what center are you in? But I didn't know about the traditions. You know, they weren't posted everywhere. And the one that leapt right out at me said was number 3, and it said, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I knew I could stay. Because you had a sign on the wall that said I had a right to be there. It didn't say that I would necessarily belong. You know, it didn't say that I wasn't different from all of you, because I was still convinced that I was. But you had a sign that gave me permission to stay in the room. And as any of my friends can testify, I have very strong opinions about virtually everything. And I can get pretty passionate about most of them. And one of the ones that, you know, gets me fired the most is when, you know, gets me fired up the most, is when, there's a Freudian slip. Now, it is when my group or any group, you know, starts practicing what appears to me something other than the third tradition. When we start putting conditions on who can be here and who can mix with us based on how they look, where they're from, how much money they make, how they identify themselves, what they may or may not have done besides drink, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The third tradition, period, to me, says the only requirement is a desire to stop drinking. And I take that very seriously because it saved my life. So anyway, it kept me in the room long enough, and one of the old people, oh, and they were laughing now, you know. I couldn't have been more insulted. I mean, I'm like, you know, you people are alcoholics, what are you doing laughing? You know, and of course I thought they were laughing at me, it was part of it. But as one woman got up, and she sort of gingerly approached me, and she said, are you new? And I said, yes. And she said, I thought so, you look scared, do you want a cup of coffee? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. Now, I don't drink coffee, I didn't drink coffee then. But, you know, it was free, so... She got up and she came back. She brought me half a cup. I thought, okay, this is one of those ones that has the brain damage thing. All right. What I didn't know, what I didn't find out until some time later, is that that was an act of love. You know, I was taught later that when we 12-step somebody, when we bring a cup of coffee to a newcomer, you know, bring them half a cup because they may still have the shakes, and you don't want to cause them the embarrassment of spilling. But I didn't know that's what was going on. You know, I didn't have the shakes, but a lot of newcomers do. And that's what she was doing, because that's what someone had taught her to do. Was, you know, you stick out your hand, you say hello, and you go get them half a cup of coffee, because you can always get them more. And I have sort of a pattern in my life of not understanding acts of love when they're directed towards me. You know? So this was really sort of symbolic of the way my whole life has been. And she sat down and she 12-stepped me. Now, she didn't sit down and read me the big book. She spent, you know, a couple of minutes, and she said, she was, I think, in her mid-50s, and she said, my name is Bernie. She said, and I, you know, I got drunk every day of my life from the time I was about 13 years old until about a month ago. And I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't had a drink since then, and my life is better. You know, what she was like, what happened, and what she's like now. That was a 12-step call. It was a short one. It was in the context of a meeting, but it was about all the message I could handle. And it made me want to hear more. And so I stuck around for another hour, hour and a half, however long it was. And I walked out of there with a big book and a bunch of phone numbers and the knowledge that maybe I wasn't quite so different. You know, maybe I was like you people, at least in this sort of one category of my life. And a few days later, the next day, I told my girlfriend at the time that I'd been to my first meeting. She had a year and a half sober at this point. And she said, "That's great. My home group's on Tuesday night if you'd like to go." And I said, "Yeah, that'd be wonderful." And so I went. And, of course, they had heard all about me. it was like a tank of sharks. There were so many teeth coming at me. But I met my first sponsor that night. I met my second sponsor tonight. He's here today along with another former sponsor of me. I had a long checkered history with sponsorship. Pretty much every man I've ever met in AA with more time than I have has been my sponsor at some point. You know, so, some things we get better at slowly. And that became my first home group. And I had a wonderful first year. It was what we call a pink cloud, and I was just, "I'm sober," and, you know, and I wanted to shout it from the rooftops. And like I said, in Minneapolis at that time, you could. So, you know, it was just delightful. It was wonderful. And I went, and you know, but that home group was a step in tradition meetings. I heard about the steps, and I learned about the steps, and I talked about the steps, and I read about the steps. I didn't actually work any of them. I don't recommend that. You know, there's a chapter called Into Action, and there's a reason for that. It's because we get better if we do something. At least that's been my experience. But again, I thought I was different. I thought I could sort of read and intellectualize about them, and I would be fine. And at about a year, things changed. I was suddenly unemployed, and I wasn't in a relationship anymore, and, you know, and I was miserable, and I desperately, desperately, desperately wanted to drink. And I kept trying to plan how to do so, except that I'd been in AA for a year, so I had all these people who wouldn't let me out of their sight. You know, I'd get up and say, "All right, today's the day. I'm going to go get a bottle." And phone would ring, and, "Hi!
Hello.
What are you doing?"
"Nothing.
Am I going to a meeting tonight?"
"Sure."
You know, and again, it was acts of love that I didn't recognize. And my sponsor had drifted away at this point, and so I asked someone new to be my sponsor. And when I asked him, he said, you know, we went out to coffee and we talked a little bit, and he said, "I don't know what you're looking for." He said, "But the only thing I know how to do in sponsorship is to help somebody work the steps, you know, take you through the book and help you work the steps. And if that's what you're looking for, I can help you do that. If you're looking for something else, I don't know that I can." And I said, "That sounds great." And that's what we did. And we sat down and we went through the book and we worked the steps. And, you know, I didn't work them with any great profundity, and, you know, my fourth step is not publishable, is a great work of art, but... you know, but I got through them, and somewhere in that sort of 6-8 month period, something happened that I didn't know was happening, and that is that I changed. You know, I had a spiritual awakening. I didn't see it. There were no fireworks. I was very disappointed about that. I like fireworks. But it wasn't terribly dramatic, but somewhere in there, the desire to drink went away. And about 6-8 months later, I hit another sort of rough patch in life, because we still hit them. And I wasn't very happy, and I was whining about things. And I realized that the only thing that was different was that this time I didn't want to drink about it. You know, the desire had been lifted. It had gone away. I had changed. I had had a spiritual awakening. I had had a psychic change, a spiritual change. And I was a changed person. I had been transformed. And that desire has not come back. You know... In 13 and a half years, roughly, since that day, since the day that I had that recognition that I had changed, you know, I have been through medical problems, relationship problems, financial problems, psychiatric problems. When I was 8 years sober, I was diagnosed with clinical depression and, you know, spent most of my waking hours trying to figure out how to kill myself. And I'm not kidding. I was literally doing that. I was sitting around weighing the options between hanging, shooting, slashing my wrists, etc. But I did not want to drink. You know, I wanted to die, but I wanted to die sober. So this thing does work in my experience if you give it a chance. I think the truest line in the big book is, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path." In my experience, if I put these steps to work in my life, I can continue to be a changed person. I can continue to be a sober person. I can continue to have a relationship with a higher power that I do not understand. But it's there, and we have a relationship, and some days I'm a full participant in it, and some days I'm not. And it doesn't seem to matter so much to my higher power one way or the other. Things seem to go better when I am a full participant, but he or she or it doesn't seem to be too offended when I'm not. So that's been, you know, in a nutshell, sort of my sobriety journey. Now, as a drunk, you know, before I got here, I felt different from day one. I mean, as far back as I can remember, I was different than everybody else. I was one of those does not play nice with other kids. You know, I as a small child, I threw tantrums, I kicked, I screamed, I bit, I pulled hair. I kicked the teacher one time. You know, I mean, I just was not a cooperative little fellow. And I, you know, I desperately, desperately, desperately wanted attention until I got it. And then I wasn't quite sure what to do with it, so I didn't want it anymore, or I wanted a different kind or something, you know. And I've always had what I call an expatriate soul, and that the only place I've ever wanted to be is somewhere else. you know, being somebody else, living someone else's life. And of course, no one understood. You know, absolutely no one understood. And like many of us, I was screaming that when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still do sometimes. What I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, among many, many other things, is that, you know, the last gasp of every dead alcoholic are the words, "But you don't understand, I'm different." And what happened when I got here is I started to say, "But you don't understand," and you said, "Yeah, we do." And more importantly, you showed me that, in fact, you did. You know, that we are the same in some way. That sort of raging feeling of being different wouldn't necessarily go completely away, but would be manageable in the context of how much we are alike. And I grew up in a functional, non-alcoholic home. It's an odd thing, but it can happen. You know, they were basically just, you know, pretty normal. I mean, they have their eccentricities, and, you know, we had our fights and our ups and downs and whatever, because, you know, it's a family. These things happen. But for the most part, they were just loving and supportive. And boy, did I resent that. Loving and supportive is just not half as dramatic as some of the other possibilities. But that's really all they ever were. And I, like I said, I just wanted to get away and be someone different and live a different life. And there was an alcohol in our home. My parents are not only not alcoholics, they're teetotalers. My mother can't choke down the, you know, glass of red wine her doctor would like her to drink every so often for her whatever cholesterol or something. You know, she said, "But I don't like the taste." Mother, that so has nothing to do with it. I mean, yeah, I preferred scotch to, you know, vodka, but hey, in a pinch, it's what's, you know, I got $1.49 I dug out of the sofa, what can I get for it? please. But the summer after I graduated from high school, a bunch of buddies and I went on a beach trip, and we found a bar that wouldn't card us and a liquor store that did, but accepted our fake IDs, and I had a chance to drink enough to feel an effect for really the first time in my life. And you know, if you're in this room, you know what happened. You know, the black, white, and gray world I was living in went boom to Technicolor. And, you know, and suddenly all the bolts were tightened down and everything was working. And I had grown up, you know, because I was a fairly bright kid. I was good in school. I wasn't one-tenth as smart as I thought I was, but I was fairly bright. And I still have that problem. And, you know, I was fairly bright. I was good in school. And I kept hearing that you have so much potential. Eric has so much potential. If he would just, you know, in the unfinished sentence, you know, just stop being such an ass. You know, he would just sort of be willing to go along with anything. And I'd heard, you know, the P word yelled at me my entire life. And all of a sudden, I got 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 or however many it was drinks in me. And I understood my potential. Because suddenly it was there in Technicolor. And the universe opened up to me in an infinite fashion. And I was the master of it. And I was like, why didn't somebody tell me what this was? You know, what I heard in high school from, you know, friends was drinking is fun. You know, that so doesn't describe this. You know, if you had told me this was the center, the answer to life, that it would make me the center of the universe like I have always deserved to be, then I would have started doing this in third grade. I mean, you know, the Bill Wilson talks about the worldly clamors that shut out the idea of God that we have within us, and I had that. I mean, you know, my head had been screaming at me from day one, and I didn't know it until that night, and it stopped. And there was suddenly silence where there had been screaming, and I didn't know the screaming had been there, and it made an incredible difference. And I thought, you know, I'm going to do this as much as I can, as often as I can, for the rest of my life. And I set out to do that, and over the next 11 years, it's pretty much what I did. I wanted to be an actor, so I went off to a very good theater school, and at that time, being a drunk in a theater school was really, certainly wasn't a problem. I think it may have even been part of the curriculum. I just fit right in. I mean, there was, couldn't swing a dead cat without bumping into a theater party, so, I had a grand time. The theater business is particularly at sort of that starting out level has built-in geographics. You know, you hate where you're at. Don't worry. Just keep going to auditions, and somebody's going to let you go tour Iowa. Cool. So I drunk myself around several states on little low-budget tours and just had a grand time. And somewhere in there, without my noticing it, that universe that had been infinite started getting smaller. And it got smaller and smaller and smaller, and did it in such an imperceptible way that I didn't know it was happening. And one day I woke up and realized that the universe wasn't big enough for me anymore. And I didn't have an answer to put it back right. Because I couldn't give up on the only answer I'd ever found. And so I continued on for a while. And my story's not terribly dramatic. I was a blackout drinker from day one, but I never woke up on a different continent. I didn't spend any time on death row. I didn't, I never got arrested. I basically, usually wound up at home or on some strange bathroom floor and usually by myself kind of wondering, wonder what happened. Guess I'll find out. Hope it wasn't too bad. And it was really mostly just kind of pathetic, because I was this guy who was supposed to have all this potential, I thought. And really I was just kind of this, bitter, lonely drunk. And that was the life I led until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that last year is a complete blur. A relationship I had gotten into in a blackout about 4 years earlier ended somewhere in there in a blackout. I don't remember the beginning or the end. And of course at the time I didn't think, that had anything to do with it. She just didn't understand. That was where I was at when I came in. And I was going to the drunken suicidal thoughts and all the things that we do at the very end until I got here and found you people. I persisted somewhat in this "do you think you're different" thing. Anyone who knows me will say that's very true. I still tend to be kind of out there marching to what I think is my own beat. What's been great in Alcoholics Anonymous, among the many things I found here, is that there's the freedom to do that. We can do that. The 12 steps I think need to be worked according to the instructions. But if I think they're very clear and very specific. But they're not carved in marble and, handed down and pounded on us. I mean, my first home group sort of tackled newcomers and gently beat them with the big book. But it was ultimately gentle and loving. And it is ultimately a suggestion. I mean, you can spend, decades in here and never work a single step. I don't recommend it. But it's allowed. It's not a rule that you have to work the steps. Those of us who have done it recommend it strongly. Try our way for a while. It's pretty good. And I tend still to be a bit of a rebel. I obviously don't have the AA haircut, or a wardrobe or car or job or girlfriend or sort of, any of the things that, that some meetings do seem to think you're supposed to have. But I have a day-to-day sort of profound joy in my life that I never thought was possible. I mean, it doesn't bubble over at every moment. I live in Manhattan. Trust me. I do not walk through my life every day going, "I'm so happy." When I almost run over a jaywalker and spill both of us in front of the oncoming truck, I do not say, "It's okay." I have my moments, sure. But basically, I'm doing things I never imagined I could do. I've had a chance to travel abroad, which I've only done in sobriety, which has been great, not just to Canada. I lived in Europe for a short time. I'm working on a graduate degree that's probably going to take me back there for a longer term. I had a chance to live in New York City, which is something I had dreamed of doing my whole life. The dreams don't always work out quite the way we think they're going to, but it was the fulfillment of a dream. I have a terrific relationship with my family today. I'm a participating member of my family today. I get up and pray in the mornings. I mean, didn't really ever think that'd be something I'd do. I had feigned religion at times in my life, but I never really thought I'd sort of like talk to a higher power. But I do, and I try to listen, and that's the most profound part of it. Like I said, I still don't think I'm like everybody else, but I'm enough like you that I know that this, what we have, is a common problem and we have a common solution. I found that here, and I found it with you people by your example, by your acts of love that I misunderstood and that I continue to misunderstand. But
One of the great things about AA is that you keep doing them anyway. You know, you keep carrying the message to me, and I keep getting enough of it that I've been able to live, you know, sober, happy, joyous, and free. And I am deeply, deeply grateful for that. And I'm delighted to be here. I am so glad that I have encountered this fellowship and you people. And see you in San Antonio. Thanks.
Thanks, Eric, for sharing his experience with us. Did anyone lose a pair of bifocals? Okay, they're right here. Also, is Clara here? Okay, if not, Yvonne, would you come up, please? They told me that I could share in between the speakers, but my sponsor told me a long time ago that speakers speak in chairman's chair, so I'm going to do what I was told and let the speakers do their thing, okay? Right. So, our next speaker is, I forgot to tell you that my hometown is Flint, Michigan, and I'm welcoming everybody here, okay? This is a great convention. It's 70 years. It's great. I'm enjoying this, and I hope everyone's having a ball here. I know I am. Our next speaker is from Florida, and it's John H. Help me welcome him.
Good morning, everybody. My name's John. I'm a real alcoholic. I can remember the times when I used to travel. I always had a brown paper bag, kind of like Joseph about that alligator luggage. I didn't have none of that. But and every time I went through, I kind of like left a trail from city to city. They would be looking for me. But that wasn't the case this time. This time I flew into Buffalo, and me and some friends drove here. And I'm not here illegal today. as one might say, all is well. When I first went in, I asked my probation officer, can I come and take this trip? And he said, no, you can't leave the state. So me and my sponsor got together, and I wrote a letter to the judge. And I asked the judge, I told him, I said, I paid my debt back to society. Why don't you suspend the probation, let me have the travel's permit. I stood in front of him, and I wanted to explain to him why I shouldn't be on probation. And he told me, I don't want to hear it. He said, but you can go to that AA thing. So here I am. When I first came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to make a lot of meetings with my sponsor. And this is the way he always introduced me. He'd say, hey, meet John. He one of them bad kind of alcoholics. And I said, God, he gonna have everybody thinking I'm the worst guy in the world. And then I began to sit and listen at you all in meetings. You all were some bad alcoholics. So I'm just like y'all. He helped me to experience that early on. See, I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. My family always told me I was hopeless. My friends told me I was hopeless. The Department of Corrections told me I was hopeless. You know, even the statistics say that 90% of the prisons will return. Even the statistics was against me. But since I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had the obsession to commit the type of crimes that send me to prison. And another reason why... And another reason why I know that I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety is that I think about the normal drinker. The normal drinker going to a bar, and he have a drink, and he get a woozy, out-of-control feeling. And he say, I'm going home. I'm going to spend some time with the family. Maybe mow the yard or something. But when I drink, that woozy, out-of-control feeling that the normal drinker get, that's a very in-control feeling for me. And I tell everybody, get back. I got this. I can handle mine. You know, and I sit there and drink until I get drunk. And there's been times when I would get up and go outside, and I would vomit until I vomit blood. And then I would go back in, and I would ask the bartender to give me a cup of ice. And I'd eat that cup of ice, and my stomach would cool off, and I would continue to drink. You know, when I drink, I can't control the amount of alcohol that I drink. And when I try to stop on my own, there's nothing in me that can do it. I'm powerless over alcohol. And I realize that today more than I ever have in my life. The drink that I see the normal drinker take with impunity, I cannot take it without developing the phenomenon of craving. That's for me. And, you know, I want to talk to y'all a little bit about my life. You know, I'm not going to say that my childhood is what made me an alcoholic. But when I got alcohol, it sure did help. You know, alcohol helped me forget about all the things that had happened to me in the past. See, I came from a family of 13. I was born in a little town called Statesboro, Georgia. I was partly raised in Vero Beach, Florida. My mother was a Baptist, Southern Baptist. And you know, my mother loved me. And she taught me everything that a good mother would try and teach her child. But at the age of 9, my mother passed away. My dad was an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. He did very little for me. There was times when I went to school and I had to put cardboard in the bottom of my shoes to keep my feet from getting wet. The other kids called me names. They often picked on me. My older brothers always called me names and said things to me. I always felt less than everybody else, you know. But something happened at the age of 14. I was with a couple of my cousins and we were going to a dance. And they stopped by a house, and the house looked like it was turned that way. The floor had broke over in it. And they asked this old guy, they said, "We want a pint of moonshine." And the guy gave them that pint of moonshine. They took a drink and passed it across me, and the other one took a drink. I didn't drink none right then. But when we got to the club, they said, "Here, take a little bit of this. It'll make you feel better." And I took and turned that bottle up, and I took a big swig of it. And I can remember, just like it was today, there was a warm, sensational feeling went down to my stomach. And when that warm, sensational feeling hit the bottom of my stomach, it exploded. Something different happened. I didn't no longer feel less than anybody else. I felt like I was 10 feet tall and bulletproof. And that night I had it going on. I was always a little shy about asking girls to dance. I think I danced with everybody that night. And, you know, I wanted to drink as often as I could. Because when I wasn't drinking, I felt that old feeling again. But every time I get a drink, I felt different. So I began to drink MD-2020 in the morning before I went to school because, what? I wanted to feel good. I wanted to be able to talk with people. And, you know, I can remember me and my friends riding that night, and we would drink a little bit, and they would say, "I'm going home. I got to go to school tomorrow." And I'd tell them, "Drop me off here." And I would continue to drink. I can remember when I first started hanging out with all the drug dealers, and I started getting a lot of nice things. You know, a guy that drank the way I did, you don't stay in school very long. They find a reason to throw you out. And my dad and my sister convinced me that I needed to go to Job Corps. They said, "You need an education." So I went to Job Corps. And we would go out on the weekend to a Liberty trip. And there was a tire up under that bus. And every time we went to a Liberty trip, we would pool our money together and get a half a gallon of liquor. And we would take it back on campus. It wasn't very long before I was kicked out of Job Corps, too. You know, and I began to hang out in the streets with the drug dealers, and I made a lot of money, and I was able to get things that I never had before. And I had a lot of fun, a lot of fun. I was able to dress real nice. I had a nice car. You know, but somewhere in life, I crossed the invisible line, a place of no return. My drinking wasn't fun anymore. Things began to happen. The police began to get mad with me. You know, you can't have a police officer for a friend when you live where a guy like me lived. They would take me to jail, and I would spend periods of time in jail. And I would get out, and then my appearance began to fail. And my family began to be moved by that. And they would always extend their hand and try to help me. And I had some good women in my life that would stand behind me and try and help me. And I would always tell them, "It's going to be different this time when I get out of jail. I'm going to do better." And I meant that with everything in my heart, that I wasn't going back to prison. I was going to do better this time. But I would fail. When that bus get just about to the place where it needed to stop, something mentally went wrong. And I said, "John, you haven't had a drink in a long time. One won't hurt." They would come and get me and take me into their homes. And I'd say, I'm not going to hurt my family anymore. I'm going to do the right thing. And I'd sit there and I'd get irritable and discontent. And I'd say, I need one beer to take the edge off. And once I take that one beer just to take the edge off, I forget about I had quit drinking. And I'd be off and running again until I wind up in jail again. I had a friend in Atlanta, and he had a little poodle dog. And that little poodle dog was bad about chewing on electrical cords. And so he always would unplug everything in the house. But one night he forgot to unplug a lamp. And that little dog got a hold of that wire, and he chewed on it, and he went running across the house. And he said every time he'd take, go home, he'd pick a cord up and shake at that dog, and that dog would holler and go to running again. You know, that dog was pretty smart. But alcohol would beat me up one side and tear me down on the other. And you take a bottle of alcohol and wave it in front of me. And I'd do it again. The book of Alcoholics Anonymous said that our dilemma is a lack of power. I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, April the 18th, 1998, I want to say this before I go any further. I had a cousin who loved me very dearly, and he thought he was going to make some money off of me, and he came and got him a life insurance policy. He thought I was going to die real soon. But you know, I'm not saying this to put him down, because I love him today, but he passed away before I did. We never know what God got for the person that we look at and put down. I can remember on April 18th, 1998. That's the last time I had a drink. I woke up that morning and my house was surrounded by Brevard County Sheriff's Department. They didn't even let me put on a shirt. They handcuffed me and they took me off. And I can remember sitting in the back of that police car. And I was saying to myself, this is it for me, because I had committed some pretty bad crimes. I did not know that that day was the beginning of a new life. They sentenced me to 5 years in the Department of Corrections. In the midst of being in the Department of Corrections, I used to walk around the recreational yard, and I used to look up at that razor wire, and I said, God, you didn't make me to be caged up like a wild animal. I'm not asking you to get me out of prison, but I'm asking you, when I get out of prison, to make me a better man, so that I don't have to come back to prison. You know, I was guilty. I had done everything that they say I did. And you know, it was shortly they forced me into a tier program. And I met this counselor, and he liked me a lot. And he said, John, do you think you're powerless over alcohol, and when you drink, your life becomes unmanageable? I said, yes. I said, you've heard my story over and over. And he gave me a book, and he told me to read it. And in the midst of reading that book, it asked me a question. It asked me, had alcoholism ever defeated me? Had alcohol ever defeated me? And God gave me a moment of clarity. I could begin to think about the time I promised that I would take my daughter to Disney. But due to alcohol and drugs, I spent all my money that night. I could remember the times when my rent was due the next day. But the night before, I drank and drugged up all my money. I can remember the times when my light bill was going to be due the next morning, but the night before I drank and drugged all my money up. I'm the type of guy that loves to fish. I had plenty of reeling rods and fishing tackle, but due to alcohol and drugs, I didn't have that anymore. And I was able to say, yes, alcohol did defeat me. It became my master. I became its slave. And then he began to work the steps with me in a short form. And before he can get finished, they shipped me to another prison. And it was called Tomoka Correctional. And in the midst of being in Tomoka Correctional, there was two guys that came out and brought me a meeting. Their name was Andy and Elmer. The service work that done in prison is a good thing, because I got sober in prison. If it was not for Elmer and Andy, I would have went right home and tried to do it again. And I believe today I would have failed. Andy, Elmer told me this. He said, John, if you ever argue with yourself, rather you can or can't drink, you will. He said, when you get out of prison, you need to put your feet in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous as soon as possible. After being in prison for 4 years and 3 months, I was released. And I signed myself up for a year in a halfway house. And my family told me, said, you're the biggest fool I ever seen. They said, after being in prison for 4 years and 3 months, you're going to give up another year of your life? See, they didn't understand what was going on in the inside of me. They couldn't feel my fear. I knew how to live in society drunk, but I had never lived in society sober. And I wanted to win this time. Drinking a lot of water. In the midst of being in that halfway house, there was a guy who used to bring a big book study out every Friday, every Thursday. And I was sitting there one night, and I heard this guy telling his story. And I sit there and I said, man, that guy, man, that's just like me. And I heard me and that guy's story. And I asked him, I said, would you help me get sober? And he told me, I'll show you what they showed me. And we worked steps 1, 2, and 3. And then when we get to the 4th step, he said, nah, John, it's time to go to work. And he had me to write down a list of all the people I hated, and I hated a lot of people. You know, the resentment list. And then after I wrote the resentment list, he wanted to know why I was mad at him. And then he asked me to pray for him. I said, pray for him. He said, yep. So John, pray for him for 2 weeks. Ask God to give them whatever you ask God for yourself. And I did that for 2 weeks. And all of it went away but 2 people. There was my father who had abandoned me and treated me bad as a child. And there was a woman who stuck a hunting rifle to my bike and shot me, and it came out my chest, and I only have one lung today from that. Whenever it get cold, I used to always think about it, and I get so angry. And I promise myself, if I live, I get even. But he told me, he said, John, think about 3 of the worst things you ever did. And I thought then, I thought about 3 of the worst things I ever did. And he said, John, do you think you should be forgiven for that? And I told him, yes. He said, I believe you should be forgiven too. He said, the reason why you done those things were because you were spiritually sick. And he said, John, the reason why they did what they did to you were because they were spiritually sick. You know, that was good news to me, that my father was spiritually sick. That meant that my father wasn't the type of man who would abandon a 9-year-old child in the midst of a crisis. That meant that my father wasn't the type of man that would send me out on a wet ground with shoes with a hole in the bottom. That meant that my father was caught in the grip of an obsession that no human power could have relieved him of. You know, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't hate spiritually sick people. We pray for them. That girl who shot me in the back and caused me to lose my right lung, I talked to her about a month ago, and I told her that I love her. And I meant that I love her, because you all taught me how to love again. I can remember sitting with my sponsor and giving him my 5th step. For the first time in my life, I was able to sit with another man and tell him my darkest secrets. I'm not alone in that area anymore. I've been released from that. You know, for many years I was dying on the inside, and nobody knew it but me. I want to tell you how bad resentment for me is. A resentment for me is like drinking a glass of poison and waiting for you all to die. If I hold a resentment on the inside of me, it will kill me. The book says that resentment is our number one offender. We must rid ourselves of resentment or it kills us. I believe that book, because that book gave me a brand new life. I can remember going back home and taking my book off the shelf and reading step 7 and getting to the part where it say, did you try to mix mortar without sand? And I could honestly say, no, I did not, because I was thorough with my sponsor from the very beginning. For the first time in my life, I had been honest with another man and told him everything about John Hunter, holding nothing back. I didn't know if he was going to report it to the police or not, but I knew that. But I knew that I didn't want to drink anymore. I'd rather be in jail sober than to be out here drunk. All I can remember when, see, my sponsor, he always tricked me. I believe he played little head games with me. When I got through, he had that list. He took that same list that way I hated all them people, and he had I've been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate toward them people, and he made me use that for 8 steps. He told me that I need to make amends to these people. And when it got to my daughter's mother, I said, why should I make an amend to her? I haven't seen my daughter in 9 years. She took all my parental rights. And if I write this letter to my daughter's not going to receive this letter anyway. He said, write the letter, John. And then I say, look, Lee, these people are not going to forgive me. These people hate me. They see me as the worst kind of person. He said, John, let's pray over the letter. I mailed that letter after we got through praying over it. After 9 years of not seeing my daughter, I got a phone call about a week later. And my daughter said, Daddy, I love you. And I want to build a new relationship with you. I want you to be a part of my life. My daughter's in college today at Florida State University. We have a close relationship. Miracles happen to me in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go into a halfway house now 3 times a week, carrying the message to alcoholics that's still suffering. They love me and I love them. You know, the steps don't take away who we are. They take away who we are not. And you know, Michelangelo was in front of a church one time. Michelangelo was in front of a church and he was chiseling on a big ugly stone. And this little old nice little old lady came out and said, son, why are you chiseling on that big ugly stone? He said, because on the inside of this big ugly stone, there stands a beautiful angel. See, that's the way the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is. When it takes away what's ugly, there stands a beautiful angel. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you loved me until I could love myself. And you loved me back to the Father until I was safely in the Master's hand. I came into this room, I brought my worst. And you all gave me your best. And when I would mess up, you would say, keep coming back. Everywhere else I had ever been in life told me, don't come back. And if I showed up to an event, they said, who told him? You know, before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had never had a life. Alcoholism and drug addiction got a hold of me at the age of 14. See, some of y'all in here have been to college and you got college degrees and you lived a pretty good life, and somewhere in life you stumbled and you fell back. But that didn't happen to me. I never had anything. So alcohol didn't take me out and take nothing from me. But I had a big game when I came into this program. Today I got a life. In a couple of months I'm going to have a wife. I own an automobile. And I got insurance on a tag and driver's license. That may not mean much to you all, but that's a big deal for a guy like me. You know, I came from one of the finest lines of sponsorship that I think a man could have in his life. I love my sponsor. I love my grand sponsor. When they're not telling me what to do, I watch them and learn what to do. At all given times, I act like a gentleman. If I beat you to the door, I'll open and hold it open for you. You know what? And the woman that I'm engaged to today, I'm not selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate toward her. I love her, and she's going to be my wife. You know, and I once heard, I don't know whether my sponsor or my grand sponsor has spoke this, he say that I'm to treat God as a gentleman. See, a gentleman won't come anywhere he's not welcome, so I invite God into my day every day. And if you don't treat him right, he won't stay. So every day you see me, I'm about my Father's business. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous changed my life. You know what? I may be different in some ways, but there's one thing that I have that all you have, and that's alcoholism. I cannot drink alcohol without developing the phenomenon of craving. I have tried controlled drinking. It don't work. I drink red liquor because that white liquor got me acting up. That don't work. I'm going to try a little red wine. That don't work. I do beer only. That don't work. I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. I love Canada, and I love all of you.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Let's go, John.
Thank you. Thank John for that great talk. All right. One of my speakers didn't show, but as a chairperson, that was my obligation to find someone else. So a person from my hometown, Yvonne G., is going to step in and speak. Yvonne?
Good morning, everybody. My name is Yvonne Gaither, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I came here to support Jesse and Mo. I didn't come to talk. But do you think I'm different? That's a heck of a topic, ain't it? I thought that all my life. In fact, I'm born and raised in Yukon, West Virginia. I'm a hillbilly. And I always told my mother and them that I must have been adopted because I felt different. I felt different, you know, and it's kind of crazy being in a black family and you felt different than your siblings and your parents. Now, I'm a coal miner's daughter, and in my hometown, everybody drank. The men drank. It was socially acceptable to make you some homebrew in your basement and to drink on the weekend. So I never saw anything about, never even heard the word alcoholism until I came into these rooms. And like I said, I've always felt different. I've always felt different than my sister and my brothers. I felt different than my girlfriends I raised up with. And I had my first drink, my first drunk. I've never had a first drink, like a lot of people. I had a first drunk. And I had my first drunk when I was 13. And so, you know, when I came in the rooms, a lot of you had the same thing. You did the same thing in your years when we should have been growing up. Our formative years, we was getting drunk, you know. But I, like the guys that shared before me, when I had my first drunk, it did something to me that nothing that prior to had never happened. I felt great. I felt like I thought everybody else did. I didn't feel different anymore. I was okay. And I chased that into these rooms. I chased that elusive feeling until I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was first introduced to the fellowship in 1976. I worked for General Motors in Flint. And when I hired in the shop, after I got on my job, and the guys took me out to lunch, and they took me to the bar, and we drank for 30 minutes, and we got a little lunch, and I went back. I said, boy, this is going to be all right. And that's what we done every day. We drank. So it became socially acceptable. You could drink on your job long as you could do your job. Well, you know that booze turned its back on me after a while, and I'm a strange alcoholic. And I got to the point where I couldn't function and drink on my job. The guys would put me in a bin and cover me up, go sleep it all. And then they would put me back on the line and let me do my job. You know, that's cute for a while, but that stuff get old. People get tired of you, you know. So this girl told me one day, she said, I got something that's going to help you out so you can stay sober. So she gave me a little old black capsule. And she told me, now you take this. Now you can drink like the rest of them. Boy, and I took that thing and I was drinking like everybody else. You know, and I was able to do my job. And I got off work and I was still feeling great. You know, and I was still on my feet. I said, boy, this is all right. And I got home and took me a bath and got ready to go to bed. And I went to bed and I laid there. And I laid there. And I laid there. And soon it was morning. So I did. This was on a payday. And I did. I got up, went to the grocery store and paid my bills. I was still functioning at that time. Paid my bills. And then I picked up my ride. This girl rode with me. I went back to work. And I said, boy, this is all right. And I didn't know that I had some speed. And every time I look up, I find a lady, I said, give me some more of that. So I kind of added that to my repertoire. And then I would see people on the line. They would, we have 5-minute break. You know, give you little 5-minute intervals. And I see them going up on the roof. I said, where you guys going? And they tell me, they said, tomorrow, Yvonne, don't drink nothing. We're going to take you up on the roof. So I went up on the roof with them. And they come up with one of these little bitty funny looking cigarettes. And they told me how to inhale on it. And I choked and coughed. And I went on back down on my job. And I was smiling. I was happy. Then I added that too. You know, and that's what I continue to do. I'm an alcoholic. But I could not, you know, somewhere down the line, I too crossed that fine line, that phenomenon, you know, that is that alcoholism. Somewhere I took a drink, and the drink took me, and I was off. The drink took a drink, and the drink took me. Well, and I was 17 when I had my first blackout, you know, and I didn't know for many a year till I came to Flint what had happened. Because, see, in West Virginia, there was nothing to do once you finished high school, and parents at that time, when I was growing up, you wasn't grown till you was 21. So I was 17 years old, and my mom said I wanted to go in the Air Force. She wouldn't sign for me to do that. I wanted to go to New York with my girlfriends, and we was gonna become movie stars or something. And she wouldn't let me go there, and she said I had to go and babysit my brother's kids, to stay with one of my brothers, until I decided what I was gonna do. Well, see, I wanted to go to the college. I wanted to go to Bluefield State and become a sociologist to find out what made me tick and what made you tick. I wasn't going, you know, I thought this was, education would make me know what was wrong with me. I knew for a long time I was different. And I knew I thought different and I felt different, even from other black folks. So I know it had nothing to do with the United States, America, as a whole. And so I wanted to go to school to find out what was wrong with me and why come I felt different than anybody else. Of course, this education trip didn't make it, but coming into this beautiful fellowship and found out I'm not different. I'm the same as all you guys. We just different nuts. You know, I would have never known that had I not come here. I would have never felt the way I'm feeling today, you know, and I wouldn't have known how to deal with my family sober. I'm the first one in my family to get sober. And they didn't understand this disease, and I don't know whether they understand it today or not. But they would tell me when I go home at Christmas time or whatever, United, them people in Flint, they won't see you. You can have a drink. Won't nobody know. I said, I'll know. So you guys enabled me to recover my integrity where I could go places and take me and stay sober. So I'm really amazed at that. And with my family, with my children hated Alcoholic Anonymous. I stopped giving them car keys. I stopped giving them Visa and MasterCard. And I was saying no. And all you do is go to the meeting with them people. Boy, they hated this thing because I was changing. You know, and they liked me not drinking. They liked when I could come home, get out the car. They didn't have to tell their friends to scatter because they didn't have to be ashamed that their mom was going to get out the car. She done peed her pants and her kids be teasing them. They liked that. But they didn't like it when I was saying no. When I tried to be the parent again, and I had a hard time with that family afterwards. You know, it's been I got sober March 31st, 1979, and it's been the greatest thing ever happened to me. You know, it's been the great sobriety. You guys have given me a loving God and my understanding, and I didn't think God was for people like me. I really didn't. I didn't know God loved me. I'm sure they said it growing up. I didn't hear it. All I heard about was that fire and brimstone God. And that he was going to get me. So when I got drunk, I said, well, you can get me now because I'm going to drink this whiskey because it makes me feel good. And it makes me okay. And there's something about putting that stuff in my system that made me feel normal. I understand why alcoholics drink whiskey. I felt normal. I felt abnormal not drinking. Something was wrong. I was restless, irritable, and discontented when I didn't drink. But when I drank, but I was always backwards. I have a spiritual sponsor said we are some backwards people. We wear a bathing suit in the winter and overcoats in the summer. So I can understand that because I did everything backwards. As a child, I wanted to be grown, and then when I got grown, I wanted to be a child. I came in Alcoholic Anonymous. I was 37 years old, going through midlife and adolescence at the same time. Boy, what a crazy feeling. You know, you want to date and have fun and skip and not be responsible. And you guys talking about being responsible. Well, see, I got in this program through my EAP rep in the shop. You know, I started getting a balance of the shift. And I'd get there a week and 3 days or 3 weeks or whatever. So finally, he called me one day. And he said, Yvonne, I hear you got 3 weeks off from the shop. I said, yeah. I didn't think nothing of it. They'd walk me out that shop I'd come to, and I got this paper, blue paper in my hand, and it just didn't register that I had a problem. It was them. It was, if they leave me alone, I'd be okay. But he told me, he said, look, we're going to get this penalty off your record. Pack your bag, and I'm going to give you some directions, and I'm going to take you to a resort. And when you come back, everything will be okay. Well, that's how I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. The resort I went to was a treatment center in Pontiac, Michigan. That's how I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that night when Jim B. came down to the treatment center, he waited till it was dark. I guess you know we all alcoholics scared of the dark. And he told me, he said, Devon, most people get a chance to find out what's wrong with them. He said, what's wrong with you is you're an alcoholic. Boy, was I mad at him. I just drank a little too much. Maybe I can't handle it like everybody else, but I'm not an alcoholic. You know, but I stayed there. I stayed at the treatment center for 3 weeks. And I went back to Flint. And you know, when I went in and out of, I went to Insight, and we was doing didactics, and they would show you stuff that didn't mean nothing to me. They'd go and show you, look in this casket, and that's you. You have a mirror, and that's you. What do you think people say when you're dying? And I'd say under my breath, I hope they throw me a little weed and some whiskey in my. You know, I didn't get no concept of all that mumbo jumbo stuff they were talking about. You know, it wasn't until I got into the rooms and you guys told me I had an allergy of the body and an affection of the mind that this thing made any sense. We were hearing about the X Factor and all kind of stuff, but nobody told me what was in that book. And say, once I take that first drink and the phenomenal craving stop, I can't stop till I black out or go into a blackout or pass out. I understood that. And they told me if I don't put nothing in me, you can't do nothing to me. And they also told me about the obsession of mind. Now, see, that was the thing that worked on me, was the obsession. Because it would get into my mind, I got to have this drink, and I don't care what would come up. You know, I would tell my kids, I'm going to be at your play. And I meant that. I meant the things I said I was going to do. But when it come time to do them, I was drunk. If I went to work, I didn't know how to say no to booze. I would tell you, I'm taking antibiotics today. I ain't drinking. And you keep looking at me, and I push the antibodies aside, and I'm drunk again. You know, so I didn't know till I came into the rooms, and I didn't know how important that I would get the strength from you guys to say no to alcohol. I took antabuse my first 15 months. Some people call it a crutch. I call it insurance against me. It was great for me. But I remember one time going to pick up my antabuse, and they told me, Yvonne, you're on your own. I said, what you mean I'm on my own? No more interviews. You can do it now. It scared me to death. It just made me draw closer to you guys. I make meetings. They say meeting makers make it. I make meetings. My sponsor put me into this program, and she gave me these steps, and I too was like the other guy that I wrote my first grudge list. And after I wrote down what everybody done to me, and she looked at me and said, what part did you play? God, didn't you hate that? What part did you play? And I had to look at the part I played. And like everybody says, instinct and collision. You know, you just can't go around and rip off the world and think everybody's going to like it. So I learned how to grow up and become responsible and how to grow down and become a child of God. I ask my God every day to help me to be everything He wants me to be and to divorce me from my negative emotions, because it's so easy to be negative. It seems like we just got a negative gene, you know. Good morning, what's good about it? You know, that's the type of people we are. Just born with a negative gene. So today I try to ask God, you know, to help me to be all that He wants me to be and let me help somebody. You know, so I'm grateful for this beautiful fellowship. I'm grateful for what He's given me. You know, I have 9 grandchildren. None of my grandkids have seen their grandma drunk. So I'm so proud of that. When my children talk about they drunk mother, and they say, who are you talking about? Because that's not grandma. And, you know, I didn't know that was so much a positive thing when they would tell them about what I used to be like. But my daughter told me just last week. She said, you know, she had to get drunk to tell me. And, you know, this program worked. But she, when I, like I said, when I come in here, she was 18. My oldest was 18. And she had become the mother, and I had become the daughter. Because she would pay the bills, and she bought the groceries, and she took care of her brothers. So she was mad as hell when I came in here and tried to take that role back. So she said to me last week, she said, I don't understand. She said, my kids don't see you as the person that I saw. She said, you were so mean and you embarrassed me in the stores and you know, just going on and on. And I told her, I said, you know what? That was an 18-year-old mother. And I said, your kid see a mature grandmother. I have grown, you know, and I wrote her many a letter apologizing. You know, and my kids, I don't know about yours, but my men's mean, give me your money. Pay me back. Catch up. I got a sponsor, he said, ketchup going fries, Grandma. You can't catch up with what happened yesterday. They got to accept us for where we are today. You know, and so I learned that I had to take the bitter with the sweet, because they're not going to always like me sober today. You know, but I try to get into these steps, and I'm learning how to be patient and tolerant. Because, see, I didn't know how to accept them when they started drinking. And when they started, you know, getting out of control, I thought for sure, because I was the only one in the family with the problem, that everybody else would be all right. Wrong. You know what? Payback is something else. I see all this heartache I caused my mom and my dad. My children have wrecked hard back on me. You know, keep me praying. Keep me on my knees. Keep me not getting into those emotional booby traps when I'm learning how to be patient and tolerant. And they're not going to get sober on my time. They gonna get sober on God's time, and they got to reach their own bottom. They don't have to reach mine. See, that's my I had to get busy when I came in here, because my job told me if I wanted what they had, I had to do something about my drinking. So I had to get busy in this program, and I love the steps. I try to incorporate every one of them in my life on a daily basis. You know, I say all the time, you guys are the wind beneath my wings. And I make meetings because I have to stay connected to you. Out there, I'm different. In here, I'm the same. I'm the same as everybody in the room. Learning to live a day at a time. Learning not to try to figure out the outcome. You know, and that's what I lived. If I couldn't figure out the outcome, I didn't want to do it. And my sponsor told me that's not spiritual. Spiritual is doing it. And the understanding might come. So you do this program. You know, you don't get better to take a step. You take a step to get better. I had to learn that too. But I wanted to get well and then I do the steps. That's not the way you do it. Here again, that backward thinking, you know. So I've learned so many little, small, simple things about the beautiful fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I work with a lot of women. And, you know, a lot of women come in and they say they have a problem with women. But see, my mother had a great neck, she had sisters. And they were always together. You know, so I didn't have any problem with women friends. You know, just you get your booze and your fella, and I got my booze and mine. You know, and I didn't have any problem with that. But this fellowship is I can't say enough about Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't say enough about every one of these steps. And like it's been said, you're the fourth step and the fifth step. But we hear a lot of people say they're afraid to take it. Let me share something with you. One of the people in my home group said, there's no need to be afraid to take the fourth step. You've already did it. All you're going to do is look at it. You've already done it. They don't go back, just look back. And see, it's a lot of wisdom for the people around the rooms who've been here before us. And they can tell us really simple things where we can stop making mountains out of molehills. You know, and I love this fellowship. I can't say enough about that. And I'm amazed that all the times I got fired, a couple of times from my job. And 4 years ago, I retired. And I'm amazed, you know. Never thought I'd retire. You know, I don't know where I thought I was going, but I've retired from my job, and I'm able to go and do things that I would never thought I would be able to go and do. Like the guy said, he'd been to Hawaii, and Hawaii is great, but go with your man. I went with a bunch of women. It was beautiful, you know, but I'm just going to close in saying that I make my meetings on a regular basis, and I do believe in trusting God and taking my inventory. And helping somebody. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Thanks, Yvonne. Could you all help me thank Eric, John, and Yvonne again? Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Okay, I want to thank you all for giving me this opportunity, And as I said, I have a choice of closing, and I'd like to close with the Lord's Prayer. Who keep us over?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us.